Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Open Talk Radio, 313 The Flash.
All right, everybody. However and whenever it is you may be listening, thank you for stopping into another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy radio show live here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash and live on the Take It Easy YouTube channel. Shout out to everyone stopping in here on YouTube, as well as all of you stopping in on Open Talk Radio. Fun show planned for you today. I have been a crazy person this morning. So let's see. We've got, I guess it's evening or afternoon, wherever it is that you're tuning in on the Central or Eastern Coast, if that's the case, or maybe some other time. But we had our podcast this morning. Then we took 2.5 hours to do the DSD podcast this afternoon, published all that, and now here we are. So we're working into – now we had a – let's see. We had a two-hour break in between there. So we are working on hour six, hour seven of podcast radio here today on this feed. So welcome in, everybody. I hope y'all are having a fantastic day so far. We are going to bounce around the MLB a little bit later. We had some fun with that yesterday with Wander Franco and the Washington Nationals. So we'll get to that. We'll also get to the Boston Red Sox winning 15-0 against the Royals right now, who have totally fallen down to earth. Regress to the mean. I feel kind of vindicated on that one. But we will get to all of that and more here on today's show. And we begin with the upcoming Game 5 here tonight between the Milwaukee Bucks and the Atlanta Hawks. This is going to be a little bit of a disappointer, and we got the news in before the show today. There will be no Giannis Antetokounmpo for the Milwaukee Bucks tonight, unfortunately, and that, you know, puts a real damper on the series here. So we find ourselves in an interesting situation between the Hawks and the Bucks, where Atlanta might have the upper hand. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen with Trae Young here, but Atlanta may end up with the upper hand here tonight, and that's gonna be kind of unfortunate down the road, because obviously we talked about this Wednesday, both on Take It Easy as well as here on the podcast and radio show. Technically, both are Take It Easy, but what I wanted to say right before that is that we were at a point where we had the Bucks losing Giannis at the worst possible moment where they could still lose the series, and they might end up losing the series, and it would make the Hawks maybe the weakest team to reach the NBA Finals in the last 26 years. They're already the first team to make the conference finals without an all-star on their team, and it's just been a weird few weeks and a weird, you know, we talked about this on DSD today. It's been a weird few weeks with the Atlanta Hawks where, you know, these runs usually last a couple of weeks and they're a nice introduction that we can remember. But by about week five or week six, we end up being a little confused with how the Hawks get to this point when Bogdanović is the second best player on the team and now might be the best player on the team and might be like the third best player on the floor tonight after Middleton and Drew Holiday. It doesn't guarantee anything because neither of those guys are superstars who will guarantee to give you 25 every night. And, you know, Chris Middleton has some duds mixed in. And then after that, the Bucks don't really have the offensive production to match up with a team that has six people who could go for 20. We don't know who's going to go for 20, but we assume someone is going to have a good shooting night for the Atlanta Hawks, whether that be Gallinari or Lemon Pepper Lou, Bogdanovich, whoever it might end up being. It'll make things interesting in the new NBA where jump shooting teams can be kind of sporadic, and so it changes the math on who's going to end up winning these different games. And so what I'm most interested to see for the Atlanta Hawks is what do you do if Trae Young doesn't play? Because obviously you've got a point to, you know, outshoot the Milwaukee Bucks. They don't have the offensive production to keep up without Giannis. Obviously you guys can score without Trae Young, at least at a higher clip than the Bucks, given that, you know, you don't have a big Middleton game or whatever might end up happening there. But if you're Atlanta, where does the offensive production come from, and do you have the strategy of just we're going to outshoot the Bucks? We're just going to shoot the Bucks out of the building and score 120 points, and they're going to score 115. But it's going to be really, really interesting, to see how this is going to play out for the Atlanta Hawks. Because it's more of a reaction now. Giannis is gone, so what is your reaction to this news, and how does it play out? So I'm interested to see how Game 5 goes. Vegas is leaning towards the Hawks ever so slightly. The lines are moving in favor of Milwaukee, and they're taking more bets on Milwaukee, which means they're feeling some level of confidence in the Hawks, even if they have they've lost some money here in the playoffs on the Atlanta Hawks. They're still holding out some hope that things work out well for the Atlanta Hawks because Vegas wants to win some money, and Vegas is good at betting those lines, so Game 5 should be rather interesting here today. Well, really tonight, but it's only in like 4 hours, so technically today if Game 5 gets underway, and by the time we come back next week, it'll be Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Or I'm sorry, not Game 7 of the NBA Finals, it'll be Game 1 of the NBA Finals by the time that we join y'all next week on the radio show. And if you're on the YouTube, we'll have some sort of live stream event in the next few days, so be sure to be on the lookout for that as well. All right. Let's talk right now about this story with the Washington football team, because it's coming in as we speak that the Washington football team is facing a $10 million fine from the NFL into investigations over sexual harassment, bullying, intimidation that went into the team as part of the story last July, where we were doing a deep dive into this story at a time where, you know, we were 4 months into no sports, and it's the story of the month of July last year, at a time of racial reconciliation and the Washington football team having to change their name from the Washington racial slurs to the Washington football team, yet I still wanted to call them the Washington racial slurs. And I'm noticing slowly but steadily that my lexicon is fading to the background because I don't call them the Washington racial slurs like I used to. But at a time of racial reconciliation that ultimately faded to the background after corporate justice got to make its stand and make it seem like there were significant gains being had in the way that people perceive race relations and racial justice and social justice causes, because it's not just, I mean, obviously the case with the Washington football team crosses racial and gender lines, because of course the name of the football team was a different issue than this that they're now being fined $10 million for, which is a rampant culture of sexual harassment throughout the workplace, which is a byproduct of the leadership of Dan Snyder, more than it was the name of a team. They weren't being fined for being racist. They were being fined for sexual harassment in the workplace, which ultimately Dan Snyder is culpable in both situations, because he was the person who said they would never change the name because it was too much of an inconvenience, per se. I mean, he had his reasons, like tradition and history, which means, like, no, I don't really want to. So Washington ends up getting fined for this, though, which is a different case that, to be honest, you know, it kind of died from the public face as the NFL's machine kind of turned into full force, and we got training camps and Hard Knocks and NFL games. We kind of lost the Washington story for a little bit in there, and this story now resurfaces just under a year from when it last happened. It's fitting that on July 1st they complete the investigation, considering that this was the story of July. I went back through the Take It Easy podcast, and I found our story from July 14th, where we talked about Washington and corporate greed and what would ultimately be July 17th, when the Washington Post story came to focus on the sexual harassment within the Washington football team and subsequent reports that followed as more women came forward to talk about their experiences, intimidation, bullying, frat locker culture, whatever you want to call it. I'm kind of just making up names for it now. And to be honest, when the story came back up, it made me feel a little sad, because I know that I personally let that story fade to the background quite a bit. And I feel a little bit guilty for that. I feel like the fact that we stopped covering the Washington story as the investigation was going on with the NFL, and the fact that the NFL did take a stand, like, I think, you know, there's journalists that have been staying around this, especially the work of the Washington Post has been excellent around this story. So there were people, you know, kind of sticking around this story and keeping powerful people accountable. And you know, you could the argument can be made that $10 million is a slap on the wrist for Dan Snyder, but it is the largest sexual harassment penalty of any sports league. I think the previous record was Mark Cuban getting $2.5 million from the NBA, but $2.5 million was the maximum that they were allowed to be fined. And they, you know, the NFL punishes on the field issue on the field controversies by taking away draft picks, and off the field issues they settle with money. And there can be an argument to be made about whether or not they didn't go far enough in the punishment, but I think it's more what the money represents than what the money is actually going to do. Is the fact that there was $10 million worth of culpability, and, you know, the NFL is not going to pay out damages. The NFL is not a legal organization, so they're not going to pay out damages to people without a court-ordered mandate. So this money is going to charity instead of, you know, retribution, or, you know, paying back damages that have been caused to women in reputation or leaving the sport or whatever it might be. So it's what you want to call a clearing of the house, per se. It's not exactly that, but it's a form of it. And, you know, to be honest, Washington, it made me feel a little sad that we didn't, you know, stick around this story long enough. And this story faded from the background as the NFL machine started going. And I feel a little guilty around it, that I didn't stick with this story the way that I stuck with the LSU story, where we had, you know, back in June, July last year, story surfacing of rampant sexual misconduct and failure to comply with Title IX and LSU selling their soul to win some championships in football. And, you know, it came at the expense of the safety of women on that campus, and not just one or two, but, you know, a few dozen. And so of those that are reported, of course, so there's obviously, you know, I would assume hundreds more based on the reporting of people who haven't come forward, and stories that end up getting lost to history because, you know, it's only a small percentage of sexual assault claims actually get processed and get to see the light of day. But at the same time, LSU kind of sold their soul on it, and, you know, we followed it up time and time again. We talked about, you know, Ed Orgeron and what his future looked like, and Les Miles getting fired at Kansas, and following up all of the reporting on this, because it is important to highlight the journalism that's being done around keeping powerful people accountable. And we did a lot of that with Washington when the content was necessary, and we faded away from it a bit. It made me feel a little sad, a little guilty that we faded away from the content a bit. And unfortunately, you know, fortunately that they came to a resolution, and it's being brought back to the surface today. But, you know, at the same time, it wasn't done with the best of execution. And that part made it a little bit, you know, it made it a little dirty, But it just, it made me feel bad. I don't know whether I should or shouldn't. Like, it's a difficulty of, like, moral judgment, but I just, as the story's breaking and I'm thinking about it, I'm like, dang, why did I not go deeper into this story? And by the way, we have the statement now from Dan Snyder, and I'll read that on the air here, which, you know, it's a statement, but I'd still, this is the first time I'm reading it. So if I say something skeptical, go ahead here. So I have learned a lot in the past few months about how my club operated and the kind of workplace that we had. It is now clear that the culture was not what it should be, but I did not realize the extent of the problem or my role in allowing that culture to develop and continue. I know that as the owner, I am ultimately responsible for the workplace. I have said that, and I say it again. I feel great remorse for the people who had difficult, even traumatic experiences while working here. I'm truly sorry for that. I can't turn back the clock, but I promise that nobody who works here will ever have that kind of experience again, at least not as long as Tanya and I are the owners of this team. Over the last 18 months, we have made a lot of changes. We have a new and diverse leadership team, wink, wink, a comprehensive program of training culture surveys and employee support, and a commitment to ensuring what every employee of the Washington Football Club comes to a professional and respectful workplace every day. While there has been real progress, we are not finished, and we will continue to improve in every way that we can. I appreciate the people who came forward and intend fully to implement all of the recommendations coming out of the investigation. Going forward, my focus will be on making the Washington Football Team a source of pride to all its employees, fans, and partners. I agree with the commissioner's decision in this matter and am committed to okay, this is very clearly lawyer speak. I agree with the commissioner's decision in this matter and am committed to implementing his investigation's important recommendations. Tanya, his wife, will assume the responsibilities of CEO and will oversee all day-to-day team operations and represent the club on all league activities. I will concentrate my time during the next several months on developing a new stadium plan and other matters. Tanya and I are grateful, truly blessed to lead such a wonderful organization that has always stood for excellence and winning and yada, yada, yada. Okay. And Jason Wright, who is the diverse hire that he's talking about, which is a black guy who had a black man who has a largely white viewpoint, I believe was the way it was described last year when they hired him as the GM of the team or CEO or president or whatever title it is in terms of running the organization. So, yeah, it's an interesting turn for Washington. And I don't know what the moral and ethical part is on this story because it kind of disappeared for a while. And a lot of the detail, I don't know if the NFL found more details, but a lot of it came from the Washington Post story that broke back in July of last year. And the story kind of going away, you know, it made me feel a little dirty that we went away from it, that I went away from that story a bit. Maybe it's a moral or an ethical conundrum, whatever it might end up being. I wish, in the same way Dan Snyder wishes I could do more. Like, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking I wish I could have done more, but also the story was there. Like, it was there to be talked about, and, we kind of forgot about it for a while, and so having it come back full circle and having it fade from this is part of the cycles of news, is that after, you know, 3 weeks, there's no new revelations, the story's out there, and it is what it is, but it's a little icky. It's a little icky that we kind of just forgot about that. And again, this comes after yesterday with Bill Cosby being released from prison, and that obviously was a changing moment because one of the things I used to talk about back when the culture was going on was that the culture, the counterculture would swing back to the culture, and we're seeing it right now. With the way that the Me Too movement has died down in significance recently, and now Bill Cosby, which is one of the big victories of the Me Too movement, if we can say victories in all the heartache and trauma that was being brought to the surface, it was the Bill Cosby sentencing was a big victory, and you know, to have that be overturned by what can only be described as like a backdoor deal. If you check out some of the reporting that's been done on this, especially I want to give some credit here where credit is due, especially the reporting that's been done by, Nikki Egan is the easier way to do it. But anyways, it's been a difficult run for, you know, it's been a difficult run in terms of these cases. And to have some, I mean, again, you could argue $10 million is a slap on the wrist to Dan Snyder, but it does reflect the largest punishment that an NFL team has offered to any, you know, any organization over workplace sexual misconduct. So you could argue that there's a victory there. But at the same time, like, it's what it symbolizes more than anything else. And symbols at this point is the only retribution you can have for, you know, the fact that this is a very real problem. And the fact that this exists in most workplaces, and women, I think the number is like 25% of women experience some sort of a sexual harassment, sexual violence, or victims of this, and many times it's more than once. And, you know, it's something that, you know, the Me Too move. But anyways, to the point I was going to say on counterculture swinging back the other way, now we're starting to see everyone started fending for themselves. And the tipping point we can point to is March 11th, 2020, which was when the COVID pandemic became like a real thing, and when we started instituting lockdowns, and when the NBA shut down, and things like that. That was kind of when the COVID pandemic kind of put everyone in a fend for yourself kind of territory, where the counterculture swings back towards the button-down culture because people are scared and more controlling, and people are more so willing to listen to what their government says, or, you know, listen to what people around are, conform to public pressure, which leans more towards the right, but also in a pro-government stance. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that swings the other way because people are scared and people are going through some sort of traumatic experience or, you know, thing that shifts, that flips the counterculture back the other way. And, you know, we're seeing it right now. We're seeing it in the way that we talk about the Me Too movement, where the Me Too movement was the most pressing issue in, according to, you know, what people deemed was the most pressing issue in today's society. They said that, you know, sexual violence, again, sexual harassment, sexual violence, especially in the workplace, was the pressing issue that we were focused on facing America. And that changed around 2020 when we saw the Me Too movement shift in the other direction. When we saw the Me Too movement, it was also amazing parallels, because on March 11th, 2020, the Harvey Weinstein sentencing went down, and Harvey Weinstein represents like the unofficial beginning of the Me Too movement. And the sentencing correlates with the day that the world shut down because of COVID. Like, one was in the morning, the other was in the afternoon. And the parallels there have changed the way that people view what the pressing issue is. And because there's not pressure to fix some of these problems, or pressure to conform and change, I mean, not society, but change social, the way that we socially interact with one another, and shame people for having opinions that might be outdated, or shaming people for misogynistic or predatory behaviors, things like that, that push change in the right direction for, you know, not, I shouldn't say equality, but for less women having to live in fear, or less women having to experience sexual harassment or sexual violence, or feel like they're being predated on when they are trying to work in an environment, especially like Hollywood and professional sports, that can be very male dominant, which is obviously a reflection of society at large, that a lot of professions are male dominated. And this is part of what progress looks like. And so the fact that, you know, progress is making a step in the other direction, and the fact that we kind of forgot about the Washington football team story, it makes me feel sad. It makes me feel sad that we are also byproducts of our society, and we're not going to get everything right. And sometimes we're going to be in the majority on this. And I think the majority was kind of fading to the background on this story. And, I have regrets about that. I have regrets about the way that we covered this Washington football team story, because after the news story stopped, and the NFL season got in full circle, and we got distracted by nice, shiny things, we kind of forgot about the story a bit. And, you know, there are some regrets to be had around that, at least for myself, and maybe other people too. But I think just the way we covered it was good at the start. We talked about it. We had nuanced perspective around this story, both this and the changing name of the team. And like with the summer of George Floyd, a lot of stuff faded to the background after the fact. And corporate justice ends up championing the change, but you know, ultimately it didn't exactly lead to sustaining everlasting movements, which, you know, it wasn't ever going to be that. Like, I understand there's limitations and the world has to operate under the fend for yourself mindset, because only once you take care of your own issues can you focus on like real world concerning problems. And yeah, it's just, yeah. I think we'll stop there before we dig down another rabbit hole here. So, what do we transition to here? Do we transition to the NCAA? I've talked so much about the NCAA today. What do we transition over to here for the last, you know, half hour, maybe less of the Take It Easy radio show here for the week? Let's talk NCAA. You know what? Let's go for it. So the NCAA's name, image, and likeness. I was also reading a story just before this about twins at Fresno State. Fresno State twins who are on the basketball team. And they have a joint TikTok account that has over 3 million followers on TikTok. And these two girls, and this is an amazing story, these two girls who play for the Fresno State basketball team got what they are deeming to be the first gigantic name, image, and likeness law in college sports. And they got a banner with Boost Mobile in Times Square that said, you know, that the Cavendish twins partnered with Boost Mobile. And they also signed with Six Star Pro Nutrition as well. And they're going to add on more endorsements from their TikTok. But they are slated after their thing went viral with their, you know, they obviously are now partners with Boost Mobile, and they have their endorsement deal with a banner on Times Square, that they may end up making more than their college president, which is excellent. And I love that idea that now college athletes can make what their market dictates, and it dictates that having 3 million followers on TikTok is a bigger market valuation than being the president of Fresno State University, which is excellent. Six Star has signed a bunch of people. De'Aaron King signed a deal with College Hunks Hauling Junk and Moving, which is excellent as a name, that he's making now more than $20,000, according to Miami Herald, and opened a store in South Florida where he will sell his own merchandise, which is fan-flippin-tastic that those people are cashing in immediately, because this is a step in the right direction. Like, superstars being able to cash in on their name, image, and likeness is a step in the right direction, and smaller people will come in after the fact. And, these twins who, you know, most basketball players don't know who they are, but they're extremely popular on TikTok, now can get that name, image, and likeness cash. And that is a massive, massive success here today. And that is a victory for name, image, and likeness, even at a time where the NCAA is working their ass off to push in the other direction. And what do I mean by that? The NCAA conceded all 50 states' name, image, and likeness legislation to create, shall we say, the NCAA ended up giving in at a certain level in order to try and win the war. They lose a battle in order to win a war, and that war is going to be over name, image, and likeness extents in collegiate sports. And that might turn out to be a victory for, you know, the progress being made, and it might be what they call the most transformative summer for the – and it's going to be a transformative summer for college sports since Title IX. But it's still a step in the right direction, but not a perfect victory. Name, image, and likeness was something that was inevitable for years. The fact that it's universal now – is pushing the movement forward, and that these TikTok girls can absolutely make $100,000 in an endorsement deal, and Derek King can make $20,000 and all that wonderful stuff that's going to help improve the, you know, capitalize on a real financial opportunity for a lot of these people. And the fact that they are ready to take that is a victory for, you know, just a victory for gaining clout and gaining popularity and being able to make income while being a collegiate athlete, which you should have always been able to do. But unfortunately, the NCAA wants to maintain and uphold their shamateurism, which I always say maintain and uphold so that it reflects the connotation used around slavery. Not that it's slavery, but it's just labor that's 16 cents on the dollar, and they can make more money there. And whether or not this is a crime is, you know, it would have been illegal in, it would have been illegal in 14 states as of today had the NCAA not changed their bylaws here. So the fact that the NCAA came around on this issue is a massive success for the sport. Yay for name, image, and likeness. Yay for Fresno State girls being able to make $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 on TikTok. Yay to name, image, and likeness. Yay to a massive victory around college sports and the NCAA that, in the grand scheme of things, it, when you're pursuing something grander than that, is a step in the right direction, but it's what progress looks like. But on the outside, let's push for more. Do not let the NCAA off the hook. That is the message that I've been saying all throughout today. Do not let the NCAA off the hook. It is a victory, but it is only a victory to a certain extent, and hopefully this narrative can be pushed forward even more as the NCAA continues around this name, image, and likeness campaign and tries to narrow things down a little bit. So this is a victory today for TikTok girls at Fresno State and De'Aaron King and Bo Nix and all of that wonderful stuff. It's a victory to an extent that we also want to pursue more of. That should be the victory. All right. So let's see what's going on in the Major League Baseball here today. Twins and White Sox. Twins are getting ready to sell real quick. They're getting closer to the deadline. Deadline day is going to be fun here. I think this is going to be the first or second year that we get a deadline day here on the Take It Easy radio show. So that it should be pretty fun. Actually, you know what I'm going to do here? Let's take a quick break here. I'd like to play a segment from the podcast here today that I want to talk about here. So we will be right back. If you're listening on YouTube, thank you for stopping in. It is much appreciated. Make sure to follow, get us over that 200 clip on YouTube. So thank you to everyone. And if you're still listening to us here on Open Talk, we are going to take a quick break here, and we will be right back with our segment from today's radio show. We are back, ladies and gentlemen, and what I want to play a little bit right now is a clip talking about the Phoenix Suns advancing to the NBA Finals. Actually, no, this is what I want to do. Let's talk more NCAA here on the Take It Easy radio show to wrap up this Thursday.
All right, because NCAA finally chipped away at amateurism yesterday by passing universal name, image, and likeness laws for all 50 states. So across the union and across the NCAA, all athletes are allowed to profit off of their name, image, and likeness without losing NCAA eligibility. And a lot of people were taking a victory lap on that yesterday, that, you know, the NCAA is finally making progress and that we are seeing the changes. And I would like to correct some of the things that have been spoken around in the narrative here with this story. Because as you know, we've been talking about name, image, and likeness laws and the NCAA's fall of amateurism and the changing tides of college sports for about, well, 2 years, because we've had this podcast for 2 years now, but it's been a pressing issue for much longer than that. The NCAA needs to continue to be held accountable. Yesterday was not a victory lap for college athletes or a victory lap for detractors of the NCAA. Yesterday was a victory lap and deserved to be so for the people who have fought years and years for the rights of student athletes, whether that's former athletes, current athletes, which is a difficult slope because college athletes move out in four-year cycles. It's the reason why they were able to perpetuate amateurism and never have a sort of movement that continued very long, was just because people would graduate out. People would leave the system and go off on their own lives, like a lot of college clubs and campus activities end up being, is that you filter new people in and out every 3 to 4 years. And sometimes a major movement like taking down a billion-dollar corporation's exploitation of its labor takes longer than 4 or 5 years. But this is a victory lap for the people who have been fighting for years on behalf of the rights of student-athletes in legislature, in social circles, in helping student-athletes understand their rights and push back against a narrative that has been perpetuated across 50 years in an effort to minimize costs and maximizing revenues, which businesses should do. I understand why the NCAA keeps up this system. When you can pay athletes 16 cents on the dollar, you should absolutely do so, and you still get to keep all your ridiculous profits that you use to have fireworks shows at a strip club to announce that you are starting a partnership with Adidas, like the University of Miami did a few years ago. And you can have $27 million facilities and however else you spend money just to make sure that you don't break even on your budget at the end of the year. So this is a victory for those people, for the people who have been fighting for years, the college athletes themselves who have pushed back against the narrative, the people who went across the seas or went to the G League instead of going to college sports and forcing college sports to rethink the way that they do their business. Those are the people who this is a victory for. Now to the NCAA. Do you know why the NCAA name, image, and likeness ruling happened yesterday? Because as of about 6 hours ago at midnight on July 1st, preventing student athletes from profiting off of their name, image, and likeness was illegal in 13 states. Had the NCAA not done that yesterday, the NCAA would have been committing a crime in 13 states, because 13 states name, image, and likeness laws, which are, again, at different degrees based on the regional politics of the state that you live in 13 different states, name, image, and likeness laws were going to go into effect. The NCAA literally waited until the very last moment, literally 8 hours before it was illegal. The NCAA's economic model would have been illegal in 13 states 8 hours later. And the NCAA got ahead of the curve and said, well, if 13 states are going to do this, we have to even the playing field and make sure all 50 states have universal name, image, and likeness laws. And they're going to adapt them, they're going to evolve them, and they're going to try and be tricky about them. The ultimate goal for the NCAA is how can we maintain this system as much as we can, and how can we prevent the kids from getting some form of power? Because right now, NCAA students have the illusion of power. They don't have real power. They are in a system where they are labor with no rights, no negotiating leverages, no ability to withhold their labor and go on strike without large organizations because they don't have an organization. That would also be illegal under federal law, unfortunately. Federal law has taken away the ability to strike and withhold labor, the only leverage tool when it comes down to it that labor has over its employment is to withhold their labor. So the college students do not have actual power. Not even Trevor Lawrence had power against the system. He tried to push back, but not even Trevor Lawrence had the power except on the social levels and the way that the locker room behaves. Pressuring your coaches to change is the only real kind of leverage that you have. But even then, it's an ironclad dictatorship, and they cycle through people every 4 years. The NCAA had to change, and they are going to continue to change their rules and make it look glossy like yesterday. And for people who have not been following this story, which is totally understandable, following NCAA bylaws and whether or not college athletes can receive name, image, and likeness compensation, which is a step in the right direction, it now dictates that college students can earn what the free market says they are worth in terms of endorsements. So money not from the university. Yet at the same time, it's not enough. And it's people have been fighting for this for years and years and taking it to state legislature and having the 13 states yesterday who passed some form of name, image, and likeness laws end up putting those into effect and therefore forcing the NCAA to change, not because the NCAA came around on anything, because it's now illegal. Because the NCAA would have been committing a crime this morning had they not changed their NCAA bylaws. And so they changed it yesterday before that goes into effect. And ultimately, what the NCAA is going to continue to push back on for the next few years and the next few months, as name, image, and likeness comes into effect and they hold on to the Supreme Court's ruling that they cannot put a cap on education-related benefits, which is a huge step. Like, this part is a big step in the right direction, is that students can now look for things that have been asked for years, graduate school scholarships, laptops, opportunities for internships while being student athletes. These are opportunities now that can be demanded of the universities by the students as some form of working closer towards that equal compensation. Because as we've talked about before, and I will mention this again, the scholarship, the free food, the free housing for 4 years that student athletes get adds up to about $160,000. This is according to Drexel University, $160,000. Student athletes with the current contracts for a Power 5 school, each one is worth about $1 million to the university. So if you take across 4 years, they are worth $1 million per student to the university. And that 16 cents on the dollar is slowly being closed with education-related benefits, getting paid with more books, more opportunities in college, and potentially after college based on how this gets implemented. And that is why it is so important to continue pressuring the NCAA to break down the shamateurism model, to put accountability to the words of what the NCAA says and hold them to the legal laws, which is ultimately the role of journalism. But in this case, it means so much because...
All right. There we have it, ladies and gentlemen. That was a nice segment from the Take It Easy podcast. If you want to check out the Take It Easy podcast, make sure to tune in anywhere and everywhere it is that you get podcasts if you want our full work all throughout. Let's finish up here today with some Major League Baseball talk because the trade deadline is going to start dominating a little bit. You find out the All-Star starters today, which, you know, it's something. But the story so far has been the Boston Red Sox, at least of recent. They won 16-1, 15-1 today, you know, just dominated. They're about 3.5 games up in the AL East. They've got the best record in the American League this year. They just don't make any sense ever, really. The Boston Red Sox don't ever make sense, but specifically this time. This time they don't make sense given that it was supposed to be a longer teardown before they rebuilt it back up. Well, Boston ends up jumping right back in, and they've got this fantastic pitching staff, and J.D. Martinez keeps going up and down and up and down, and Xander Bogaerts has been great this year, and they've got Michael Chavis and Rafael Devers, and they cleared out their entire outfield from last year, and yet they continue to win games at a strange rate with, you know, Hunter Renfro and Alex Verdugo and all of those guys that Boston keeps trotting on out there. But Boston has been interesting for a few reasons because they have the pitching staff to make a deep postseason run. They play in a division where, you know, we might expect that they regress to the mean at some point. Like, it's been very strange to see them be as good as they are, despite the fact that, like, Toronto and Tampa Bay, who Toronto's 8.5 behind them, but Toronto has a higher run differential than Boston. Obviously, Boston's been on a win streak recently, which is gonna play some into it. Like, they'll regress to the mean at some point after, you know, sweeping the Royals. But I find it hard to believe that, like, Hunter Renfro and Gay Hernandez are, like, just the end-all be-all that are changing the franchise. And, you know, Boston has been a huge success so far this year, and I'm interested to see whether or not they progress or regress to the mean, because Boston has been really good for a really long time, and they keep having these weird years where they go down, but we expected this time it was going to be different. This time it was going to take a long while for Boston to get good again, and, you know, maybe they regress to the mean a bit at some point here. I know I like saying regress to the mean a lot, but it is poignant here for Boston because the Red Sox cleared out the old guard from a World Series team, kept a lot of the young pieces, still have a lot of big contracts like Chris Sale and Nathan Eovaldi. You know, they cleared out a bunch of money, cleared out a bunch of players, and, you know, small pieces like Garrett Richards and Kike Hernandez are like the ones that are turning it around. I find that hard to believe, but it's been quite remarkable, the success for Boston this year and their best hitters down the lineup, as I mentioned before. I actually just want to make sure I see who has been the best hitters for Boston, because I was surprised by this with San Francisco. That's like people that I once knew. And Boston's best hitters this year have been Verdugo, J.D. Martinez, Devers, Bogaerts. Renfro's hitting .804 OPS this year. He's had a fantastic turnaround finally. It makes me feel good as a San Diego Padres fan to see Renfro hitting like a crazy person. They've got like six hitters that hit better than anyone on the Kansas City Royals. Well, Salvador Perez is pretty good. So everyone non-Salvador Perez category on the Kansas City Royals. Even Andrew Benintendi, who they got rid of at the end of last year. I don't even think he's playing right now for them. I think he's injured. But still, Andrew Benintendi gets to be on that list too, now a Kansas City Royal. And, you know, the Red Sox got a bunch of random dudes together, and with their core guys who are still together from the World Series team, Martinez, Bogaerts, Devers, only 3 years removed from a World Series team. You know, Boston has been quite remarkable so far. And obviously, Nathan Eovaldi has had a career revitalization. It's been quite remarkable to see Boston have the turnaround they had, just because, you know, we didn't think they were as bad as they were last year with the short season, and it worked to their benefit because they're going to get like a top three pick in this year's draft. But I don't think we really expected what's happened now for Boston. We didn't think that that was going to be the outcome, was this sharp turnaround that Boston has had that puts them with the best record in the American League. And while there's, of course, probability for regression to the mean, it does seem quite remarkable that, that Boston has been as good as they've been. And also, you know, Houston always comes up. Houston, if it's not Yankees and Houston, it's the Red Sox in Houston, because of course it is. That's baseball, right? It just keeps turning up the same teams over and over again, with teams that hang out in mediocrity, and maybe, just maybe, they can turn things around down the road. You know what? The White Sox have been good this year. I'll give the White Sox a shout-out. The Diet Padres have been pretty good this year, so shout-out to the White Sox as well. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to call it here for the week. Make sure to follow on YouTube, Comical Sports. Follow the Take It Easy podcast. Buy some merch if you want. We got all kinds of stuff there. And ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, take it easy, everybody. Thank you again so much. Enjoy your 4th of July, and we will talk again next week.